From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the history of Milwaukee's Humboldt Park, which dates back to 1890. Then, a new Bulber Talk uncovers the victims of the Bayview Massacre and where they're buried in Milwaukee.
This is a war scene. You know, this is something that we sort of look at it as the distance of history. It's somewhat tamer. This was violence.
Plus, we'll tell you about a documentary about Italian cookbook writer Marcella Hazan.
I've been cooking her recipes for decades, and every night I go to the kitchen thinking, what do I do with this ingredient? And the answer is, you know, what would Marcella do?
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. The Bayview Massacre was a turning point in Milwaukee's labor history. But what happened to the protesters who were injured and killed on that day in the late 1800s? We'll find out later in the show. This weekend, the Bayview Historical Society will designate Milwaukee's Humboldt Park as its historic landmark for 2025. The honorary designation will be the nonprofit's 30th site. Today, Humboldt Park is home to Chill on the Hill, community events, fishing in the lagoon, the Vine Beer Garden, and so much more. It took a lot of work to shape the park into its current footprint, and to learn more about its history, I met with Bayview historian and author Ron Winkler in the park. He begins with sharing Humboldt Park's creation story.
It was just land that belonged to two families. It was the Mann family, and their mansion still stands on Logan Avenue, just north of Idaho Street. So they owned that land, and then the other land that became part of Humboldt Park was owned by the Wilcox family, and that was the western part. So the initial park, the boundaries were from Logan Avenue to Howell Avenue. Southern boundary was Oklahoma Avenue, which at the time was Milwaukee's southern boundary. And then Idaho Street was the northern boundary. So that was the initial acreage that was purchased for the original Humboldt Park, which of course at that time was called South Park. So there were five parks that were created in 1890.
Right, and this was before we even had a Milwaukee County park system, right? These first five parks?
That's right. They were in fact created by the city of Milwaukee because there were no free public gathering places. There were a few small squares and triangles and things that were green spaces, but not very big. And there were beer gardens, but the beer gardens charged. So the city wanted to provide something for all of the citizens. So they created five parks. South Park, which became Humboldt Park, Lincoln Park, which became Kosciusko Park, North Park, which became Sherman Park, West Park, which became Washington Park, and Lake Park, which is the only one that has retained its original name. So
who was the Humboldt that Humboldt Park is named after? Because it was renamed, what, a couple years after it was first established?
In 1900, yes.
Okay.
And it was named for Baron von Humboldt, who was a lifelong resident of Berlin, which was at that time part of Prussia. And he was quite a Renaissance man. He was kind of like our Wisconsin Increase Lapham, but on a much larger scale. And he traveled a lot of places and did a lot of research and exploration in areas that had only been explored by Spanish-speaking people. So he did a lot of work on the western coast of South America. So what he did was to do a lot of research, and it was just incredible what he found out. He even was able to determine through his studies that human-induced climate change was taking place. So he is considered the father of climatology and environmentalism.
So we're sitting in front of the lagoon, which is kind of the park's main focal point, central location. It's looked different over the decades, even centuries, since this park was first established, but it was built into this park, correct?
That's correct. The park was opened up in 1891, and one of the first projects they did was to create a lake, or a lagoon, as we refer to these in Milwaukee. So what they did was to create a small lagoon, and they put a boathouse on the south side of it, and that was in 1893. And then in 1910, they moved that boathouse over to the present location of the pavilion, and in preparation for that, they created an island. So that was quite a big undertaking. And then they built the boathouse, which was made of concrete, and they connected it to the island, and people could cross and have picnics and view the lagoon from that island. So that boathouse had, as the name implies, rowboats that were for rent, but so did the original pavilion. And then they also had a warming room for ice skates and ice skating in the winter, and they also had concessions there, and it was open for meetings and gatherings and different occasions. So that was in 1910, and then in 1928, they expanded the lagoon again, because in 1920, land north of Idaho Street was purchased, and then the park became its present size of roughly 73 acres.
Right, so some of these buildings, like the two-story boathouse, there's some photos of what this lagoon looked like at its peak, and it's so impressive. But yeah, some of these buildings aren't here yet today, but the pavilion behind us, you see some of the land and stone, some of the original historic structures. And I had always assumed, like, maybe this was always here, but turns out it was built for the park as a maintenance structure and some other things. But for the building surrounding the pavilion, we also have tennis courts here. Does the general layout, is it similar to what it looked like at its peak?
Yes, pretty much so. The only difference is that there have been additions of playgrounds, the tennis courts were originally clay, and there's also a wading pool that is adjacent to the current service building. But you mentioned about this pavilion, which originally was the service building. That was built to replace the original boathouse, which was moved over here. And that was, of course, in 1910. And then, during the Depression, there were three WPA projects that occurred here. The building of the service building, the construction of the band shell, and an actual enhancement of the creek that used to flow from the lagoon. It took the overflow from the lagoon and then ended at the corner of Quincy and Oklahoma Avenue. But what you mentioned about this looking like a farmhouse, that's spot on, because it was intentionally built to look like a New England farmhouse. And in fact, there were different flowers and vines and things that were in back. If we look at the top of that building, we can see that there's a weather vane, which is a nod to the WPA workers who built it, and they intentionally included that, and it shows a worker with a wheelbarrow. And then in 1961, when the current service building over on Howell Avenue was constructed, that was built to look like this pavilion or the former service building.
I love that weather vane nod to the WPA. I've looked at it all the time and I never made those connecting points. Now, you mentioned the band shell as part of those WPA projects. Now, the one that's standing here currently is, they call it a more Swedish chalet style band shell, but the original one had that classic 1900 Art Deco inspiration, kind of looked like the Washington Park band shell, right?
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, it was modeled on the Hollywood Bowl and also in Chicago, but on a much smaller scale. But the Washington Park band shell, which still exists, was they were constructed at the same time as WPA projects. So this was in 1932, and it was the firm of Kloss and Kloss. And the way it was built, the inside was so reflective that they didn't need any lighting because the lighting from inside projected out to the seating for the audience. And there's a gradual slope uphill, and they used to have benches there, and it could hold up to 2,000 people. That was one of the top things in the park. There were all kinds of concerts and opera and very famous people who came here and also to Washington Park. Unfortunately, in 1976, due to arson, the band shell was destroyed. And the next year, it was rebuilt as the Chateau. And that Chateau was built upon the base of the old band shell. So that opened in 1977.
Yeah, and it's home to Chill on the Hill every Tuesday in the summer. And speaking of summer concerts, I think the Baby Drumline is practicing in the distance over there. But that's kind of what I love about Milwaukee's county parks like these, is that it's such a central point to bring people together, no matter what activities they're doing or if they need an escape or just need to enjoy some green space. So thinking about the work that it took to build out this park, and having grown up here, ran through here during high school, cross country meets, all the things that it's played in your life, what's your favorite aspect about Humboldt Park?
I think it's the green space, which is really what we need nowadays. It's been shown that having these green spaces in cities is very beneficial for body, mind, and spirit. And in fact, the temperature is about 10 degrees cooler when you have these green spaces. And it just helps everybody's psyche to have this. And there are so many activities that people can participate in here, because there's walking and running, as you mentioned, there's the playgrounds, there's fishing, there's the different events that the Humboldt Park Friends sponsor. And it's just being able to come here and get a break from our urban perplexities and all of the anguish that accompanies our everyday living nowadays. It's great to see these trees, and there's flowers. The Humboldt Park Friends, they are the reason for this green space that we have.
Well, Ron, I want to thank you so much for spending a little time in the park with me today. I really enjoyed learning more about its history.
thank you very much. I once again enjoy sharing Bayview's history with you.
Ron Winkler is a Bayview historian and author. We met at Humboldt Park ahead of the ceremony to designate the park as a historic landmark. The event is this Saturday at 1 p.m. and is free and open to the public at the Humboldt Park Pavilion.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
On May 5, 1886, thousands of protesters in Milwaukee were nearing the Bayview Rolling Mill when the first shots rang out. The protesters were part of the 8-Hour Movement, seeking better working conditions for laborers in Milwaukee and beyond. State militia had been tasked with guarding the mill. Historian John Gerda explains.
A crowd of roughly 1,200 strikers, largely Polish, gathered at St. Stanislaus Church on 5th and Mitchell, marched down Mitchell Street first and then Kinnickinnick to march on the rolling mill. They found the militia waiting for them, and at a distance of roughly 200 yards, the militia opened fire.
As the smoke faded, the devastation became clear. At least 9 people had been shot. The event became known as the Bayview Massacre. But who were the victims, and where were they buried? That's what listener Brenna Ackert wanted to know. She began her own research into the victims, but wrote to Bubbler Talk after reaching some dead ends.
So I was curious if anyone could find any information, because I certainly couldn't. Sometimes we can find names, but that's usually about it. That's like as far as we could go, at least in my own digging.
But let's take a step back and look at what led to the massacre. The 8-Hour Movement was born out of the poor working conditions for factory workers in the mid-1800s. Laborers were expected to work 6 days a week for 10 to 12 hours at a time in grueling conditions.
Their goal was an 8-hour day without a cut in pay. So if you're working 12 hours a day for a buck and a quarter a day on the labor side, that's a big deal. So it was a major request. And Milwaukee and Chicago became the epicenters of that movement in the entire country. And the first week of May 1886 was really among the most volatile in Milwaukee's history.
Starting on May 1st, laborers in Milwaukee and Chicago went on strike. Both cities were filled with strikers, united by a common cause. But on May 4th, these protests turned deadly in Chicago when an unknown man threw dynamite into the crowd, killing at least a dozen people. At the same time, tensions were rising in Milwaukee. Wisconsin's Republican governor, Jeremiah Rusk, had ordered the National Guard into Milwaukee to quell the protests. As protesters neared the mill, the orders were given.
The captain of the militia said, pick out your man and kill him. So this was not shooting over their heads to frighten the crowd and have them go back to the south side. This was certainly intentional.
According to news reports from the day, the street looked like a battlefield. People lay dying, bleeding. Since 1986, the centennial anniversary of the massacre, the Wisconsin Labor History Society has held a ceremony honoring the dead with 7 beats to represent the 7 victims believed to have died that day. As question asker Brenna Ackert mentions, there are a number of named victims, but the names change depending on the source you're looking at. What remains consistent is the number, 7. After a quick, targeted search on Ancestry.com, using the most consistent names listed, I was able to find death certificates for 4 of the named victims: Frank Kunkel, Frank Navarchek, Martin Yankoviak, and Michael Rakalski. These death certificates are very helpful because they include other identifying information, including where they were buried. But that was where my good luck ran out. As I started to search for other names, it became clear this would be a difficult task. John Gerda notes that's kind of how this research goes.
Tedious, granular, and I think the lesson from a lot of this research is that history is messy.
To dig into this mess, I used 3 main resources in the Milwaukee Public Library's Zeidler Room: city directories, historic newspapers, and local history books. I started by trying to find these men in the city directories with mixed results. That's when I headed to the historic newspaper database to find contemporary accounts of what happened that day. But these newspapers, while helpful, are only as reliable as the author, as librarian Heather Smith explains.
You have to understand how information is collected and recorded.
She uses the census as an example.
So if a census worker who's a complete stranger to you comes to your door, they're going to write down what you tell them in their record. So if they get some detail wrong because they perceived that you spoke with an accent and they didn't clearly understand what you said to them, that's what gets put into the census records that we now are using for research decades later.
A few things became clear in reading the accounts from that day. The scene was chaotic, and American journalists weren't great at deciphering Polish names. Some victims I had confirmed through death certificates had entirely wrong names listed in the papers. In one article on the day of the massacre from the Milwaukee Daily Journal, Frank Nowarczyk was listed as Jacques Narakak. Martin Jankowiak was instead called Marcus Jokowski. It also included John Marsh among the victims. Now, John Marsh was one of the three remaining names that I was searching for, along with Johann Zaska and Robert Erdman. But as the dust settled the following day, there was an updated list in the Daily Journal with the proper names of everyone who had been shot. John Marsh was now John Maschk. John Maschk had a death certificate that confirmed he'd been killed during the massacre. The misspelling of his name wasn't an anomaly, as librarian Heather Smith notes.
All of this stuff was, in many cases, communicated verbally. If things were written down, they were written down in a non-standardized fashion, which is why you'll find variations in spelling in historical records.
In fact, different newspapers would often write names differently. Although he was known as John Maschk in the Daily Journal, he was called Johann Maschke in the Sentinel. Over time, it's likely that John Maschk had been split into two separate victims due to the variance in how his name was spelled. Reading through the newspapers of that time shines light on another reality. Many didn't view these protesters as victims, and that's borne out in their death certificates.
The certificate of Michael Ruchalski, the cause of death is listed as shot in a mob. That's editorial. That's saying this is a guy who was kind of out with the rabble. And it was a fairly accurate reflection, I think, of how people in the mainstream, you know, kind of thought of the disturbances in that first week of May.
That gets to another reality. Most newspapers seemed more concerned about the threat to public order than they were about the fate of those who had been shot. Updates on the injured sunk lower and lower in the newspapers. Most had stopped covering them entirely less than a week after the massacre. Instead, the newspapers focused on the criminal trials of those who had led the movement.
Any threat to law and order is met with resistance by the establishment. That's why it's called the establishment. You know, both the corporate side and the media side as well. So you have a city shut down by strikers who were marching from one employer to another to dramatize their demands. That was clearly a challenge to the status quo.
The majority of protesters were recent immigrants, and not all of them had ties to the community. These were people who could go missing without much notice, making it very difficult to track them down. The massacre had also pitted neighbor against neighbor. The local Kościuszko Guards were among the militiamen who fired on the protesters. They were also Polish immigrants who lived in the same community. While the newspapers lauded the bravery of the militia, many in the Polish community came out against them.
They were boycotted by the people on the south side. And at the same time, people of Polish background in general were kind of stigmatized as Polanders and drunkards need not apply to jobs. So they were kind of the troublesome workers. But also internally, you know, there was division about, you know, the people who were being shot at and the people who were shooting.
It's unclear what happened to the four other victims with serious injuries. But after a lot of research, I can definitively say at least five people died. And I know where they're buried. Holy Trinity Cemetery, now part of St. Adalbert Cemetery in Milwaukee's Morgandale neighborhood. With this information in hand, I went to the cemetery with our question asker, Brenna, and told her what I'd found.
You have really tracked down so much information. I'm so glad I reached out to Bubbler Talk to say, hey, take it away from here. Thank you for looking into this. This has been incredible.
We checked in at the cemetery office and asked them to look up records from the 1880s. There wasn't a single record left from 1886. The exact location of the Bayview Massacre victims' graves seemed to have been lost to time. But the people they represented are still there, and their stories still resonate with our world today.
The larger picture is absolutely incontrovertibly correct, you know, where you have an oppressed workforce resisting oppression and the forces of capital clamping down, closing in. That's the story, and we need to keep sight of that and the impact it had on politics later on families certainly. So whether it's 5, whether it's 7, whether it's 9, people died. And they died violent deaths at the hands of their neighbors.
At least 9 people were shot that day in May. Many were severely injured, like Kazimir Dudek, who was shot 4 times in the arm and lost half his jaw. Most victims were laborers whose livelihoods depended on their good health, and those who survived were never the same after that day. But neither was Milwaukee. Although these protests were incredibly controversial, the massacre had helped shift public opinion on labor rights. The sacrifices of the protesters led to better working conditions in the mills and factories, and the rise of a new political party.
It broke the back of the 8-hour movement, but also galvanized those workers to organize politically. So they established a People's Party that swept the next elections, the fall elections. And that was a very important catalyst for the rise of the socialists in Milwaukee.
And maybe learning all of that is worth a bit of digging. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
In about 15 minutes, we'll speak with an artist about his unique medium for painting portraits of Milwaukee.
I just had an Altoid container laying around, and at that point I had been oil painting for about a year, so I decided to just try it out and put some paint in the bottom of the tin, use that as the palette. And at that time I lived on the east side of Milwaukee, and so I just walked down to the art museum, sat on the grass, made a little painting of it, and that's kind of how I started the tiny Altoid paintings.
But first, we'll hear from the director of a documentary on a beloved Italian cookbook writer. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. Listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Marcella is a documentary named after the late Marcella Hazan. She's an Italian-born cookbook author. WUWM's Mayon Silver is joined by Peter Miller, who directed and produced the film, to learn about the beloved cook and her culinary influence on so many people.
First of all, I just watched the film, and Milwaukee gets mentioned in the film. Are you familiar with that? Did you know that? One of the people you speak with says that she has a book tour signing in places like Milwaukee.
Oh, the astute watcher will notice that Milwaukee gets a mention, which is just an amazing thing that you saw that. So, you know, Marcella Hazan mattered so much in people's lives. I mean, and I'm among those people. I've been cooking her recipes for decades, and every night I go to the kitchen thinking, what do I do with this ingredient? And the answer is, you know, what would Marcella do? And Marcella's a voice in my head, and I, you know, she really means something to me. And clearly she meant something to parents across the country. There's any number of kids who were named Marcella for her. And in the film, there's one of our interviews says, you know, Marcella would be at a book signing somewhere in the country, Milwaukee, Los Angeles. And somebody would come up to her and say, I name my baby for you. And it made Marcella cry.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
So one of the clips that I wanted to play for you is Marcella's voice herself. You know, we want to introduce people to her if they aren't familiar with her. And there's this clip right here. She is in a market in Italy, and she's talking about the food.
The one who has the higher price is written a word that is Nostrani, that means local. They cost much more. And the people is willing to pay more because they were really fresh.
And basically it's where Italian produce is labeled that way if it's directly from the local area. What was the importance of that, like, to her and to her life?
So now, Marcella was really committed to eating the best ingredients, cooking with the best ingredients, and the best ingredients usually meant something that came from nearby, something that came from your community that had what they call nostrana, which means ours. And if the food, if the ingredients are better, if you're working with Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, or if you're working with good extra virgin olive oil or produce that comes from a farm nearby, it's just going to be a better experience and you're going to have better food. You know, Marcella's recipes were not complicated. She wasn't a restaurant chef making fancy dishes. She was making food for home cooks and recipes that home cooks could follow. But if you follow those instructions, which is cook simply and according to wonderful tradition and choose good local ingredients, I mean, that just makes such a difference. And she was saying this stuff long before we had the farm-to-table movement and farmers markets everywhere. This was something she learned from her experience of being Italian.
And so there are so many cool things about Marcella that you learn in this movie. For instance, she taught herself to cook. I mean, that's kind of a fabulous kind of idea that she ends up learning all these techniques just on her own. I mean, what did you learn about her journey there?
You know, this is a film about cooking and about food, but it's really the story of an amazing person's journey through life. Marcella was a scientist. She had two PhDs in science. She never cooked until she got married and went with her Italian expat husband back to the United States. And he asked her to put a meal on the table every day. She said, I'd never boiled water unless it was in the beaker in the laboratory before. I mean, this is a person who was highly overqualified for this task, but she wanted to put a meal on the table in America, and she got an Italian cookbook, and she reverse-engineered those flavors that she remembers from her life in Italy. She was entirely self-taught, but soon she was giving Italian cooking lessons, and she was such a brilliant mind that she was able to translate what she remembered from Italian cooking to Americans who wanted to learn how to cook this magnificent cuisine.
Also, the way she measured, I'm guessing there's a lot of chefs that are like that too, but there was a clip in the film from one of her friends, Bill, who's in the movie, and he's talking about taking cooking lessons with Marcella.
And I said, Marcella, your recipes are so precise. I can't believe that you just threw all that salt in the pot. And she said, I never measure anything. She said, and now you cook it. And I said, with my pencil poised, for how long? And she looked at me with great disdain and said, till it's done.
And Bill gives a great big smile there. Can you talk about how that sort of epitomizes her approach to food?
Well, Marcella would say that Italian cooking is simple, but it's not easy. I mean, it's often you're making recipes that have just two or three or four ingredients. I mean, her famous tomato sauce with tomato and onion and half a stick of butter and salt, that's all there is. But if you follow her instructions, it's the most magical sauce you could ever make. And so much of what she taught us is about simplicity and technique, about really following your instincts, but also following handed down knowledge. And so, yeah, her recipes are super precise. They tell you exactly how much stuff. But in reality, Marcella never measured. She'd throw in what she thought there should be. And so there's this kind of paradox, which is that she's giving incredibly precise ingredients, but she's encouraging you to use your wisdom and to tap into common sense. She says the most important ingredient in the kitchen is common sense.
That's amazing. I read that one of the reasons you actually got the idea to do a documentary on her was when you were preparing ravioli with your wife. How has she seeped into your life? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Pretty much every night when my wife and I go to the kitchen and cook, and we love to cook. You know, the two things I love to do are make documentary films and make dinner. And, you know, most nights we're there looking at our produce or looking at our meat and saying, okay, what are we gonna cook tonight? And Marcella has been this steady presence in our consciousness. It's not just the fact that her recipes are great. It's that there's this voice in her writing. She's such an amazing writer. And of course, a lot of her writing is in collaboration with her brilliant husband, who, you know, was behind the scenes crafting this prose with her. But I'd be, you know, in the kitchen reading her thing, and I can hear her voice scolding and cajoling and instructing. She's just this larger-than-life presence in my own life. And, you know, one night after we just got the crazy idea to make homemade ravioli, you know, a couple hours into the process, because there's a lot of work there. You've got to roll the dough, and you've got to make the stuffing, and you've got to build them. My wife looked at me and said, has anyone ever made a documentary about Marcella? And I looked at the internet, and I saw that nobody seemed to have. I contacted her son, Giuliano, who's also a great cooking teacher. He was easy to find because he offers cooking classes. So I reached out to him, and he said, no, but I'd love that. But you got to talk to my dad. And I said, your dad? I had no idea Victor was still around. He was well into his 90s at that point. And I called up Victor the next day, and he said, I'd love for you to do this. By the way, I'm in Florida, and you're in New York. I'm coming up to your part of the world in the next couple weeks. Why don't you interview me? So I thought, this is just, you know, I'm being instructed by higher powers to do this. He came to my living room. I interviewed him for 3.5 hours. He was the most brilliant, articulate interview I've ever conducted, and we were off and running.
That was Victor.
That was Victor. Victor came to my house, delivered the most extraordinary interview, full of stories and insights and poetry. The guy was brilliant, and we were off and running. I mean, it was clear this film had to get made.
And one of the things that struck me about Marcella's biography is her hand injury. Here's a clip of her son, Giuliano, talking about the assistance she'd have to make things like homemade pasta.
I think the fact that she hurt her hand and it never went back to being what it was, it was very difficult for her to do things with her right hand. But it never stopped her from doing anything. I remember that she would tell her students often, you know, if I can do this with 1.5 arms, then you should have no trouble doing it.
What can you tell us about this injury and how it shaped her, really, and how she kind of became someone to emulate in that regard?
Well, this is a story about cooking, but it's also a story about disability. I mean, Marcella had injured her arm as a child, and it never got better. Her right hand, and she was right-handed, was really barely functional, and she had to hold a knife with it, and she had to work with this disability in order to prepare fantastic meals, which would be a challenge for anybody. But in some sense, you could say that maybe that disability was part of how she got her willfulness. And, you know, this is a person who was extremely strong-minded and strong-willed and, you know, would tell you what she was thinking and nothing would stop her. And, you know, does that come back to having to deal with this disability as a child? I mean, this is a different era for disability. Now people might say, this is my condition. There are ways in which to work with it. But back then, it was something of shame. I mean, she would hide her disabled right arm but underneath a sheath. She'd keep it behind. You look at the photos, and oftentimes she's got her hand out of the frame, you know, because this was something that she did not feel good about. She didn't love watching herself on television with her injured right hand. Thank goodness times have changed and we approach disability in a different way now. This was something that I think really did shape her.
She nonetheless wrote many, many cookbooks in Italian. Her husband would translate them. You know, she won 7 James Beard Awards. She was just someone who continued in this sort of mission of spreading good food and good eating in Italian ways. I was wondering what you think someone like Marcella would say about the food and recipe scene of 2025, you know, with Instagram and quick cooking videos and, you know, anybody with video skills being able to produce food videos and travel videos and what I eat in a day videos. How do you think she'd relate to that?
See, Marcella was all about flavor, and she was all about feeding delicious food to people you love. She's a person who wrote books for home cooks to prepare good meals to sit at a table and enjoy together. She was never about flash and presentation. She was never about photographable, Instagrammable food. That wouldn't be who she was. If you look at her great cookbooks, the classic Italian cookbook and its follow-up and then Essentials of Classic Italian Cuisine, these books are barely illustrated. There's no glossy photos. There might be a drawing to show you how to dismantle an artichoke or how to do something in your kitchen. But it was the text, it was the messages in the book that mattered. It wasn't the pictures. It wasn't putting it on a plate in a little pile with, doodads around it. This was solid, delicious food prepared lovingly for people you love.
Peter Miller, thank you so much for chatting with us about your new documentary, Marcella.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Peter Miller, director of Marcella, speaking with WUWM's Mayon Silver. You can now find the documentary on Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, and more. We'll take one more break and then meet an artist creating scenes of Milwaukee inside Altoid tins. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Atomic Records, Klingers East, and the Milwaukee County Stadium. Wisconsin artist Nate Rose has gained attention for recreating all of these local landmarks of the past as tiny paintings inside of Altoid tins. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Rose about this series of paintings called Milwaukee Memories.
What inspired you to start this series of paintings?
Well, I can't take credit for coming up with this idea. I think I saw it on Instagram or something a while back. But I just had an Altoid container laying around. And at that point, I had been oil painting for about a year. So I decided to just try it out and put some paint in the bottom of the tin, use that as the palette. And at that time, I lived on the east side of Milwaukee. And so I just walked down to the art museum, sat on the grass, made a little painting of it. And that's kind of how I started the tiny Altoid painting. So it's only been about a year and a half that I've been doing these. And so the lid of the Altoid tin has a little 2x2 canvas on it. And then in the bottom part of the tin, there's little dabs of oil paint, the various colors that I use. And then kind of in the middle of the bottom part of the tin is where I mix them. The little painting itself will probably be dry in about a week, but these little dabs of oil paint could be wet underneath for months and months.
And when did you start the series of painting Milwaukee memories or Wisconsin memories?
This is like a pretty recent thing. It was actually a shower thought. I was actually thinking about what local landmark I wanted to paint next. And I was like, oh, it'd be nice if I could paint like Port Plaza Mall in Green Bay, which is no longer there. But I grew up in Green Bay. It was kind of like where we always hung out. And then I thought to myself, well, why not just paint it? And so I did a bunch of research and found photos and tried my best to remember kind of like what it looked like, what the vibe was. And then I just painted it, took a picture of what's there now, which is really boring.
And you mentioned Port Plaza Mall, but for listeners who aren't familiar with your work, tell me about some of the places you have painted.
Well, here in Milwaukee, I painted Atomic Records, which was on Locust, closed around 2009, I believe. I painted Klingers East, which closed a few years ago, also on Locust, but in River West. I painted Fuel Cafe, which was on Center Street in River West, and Milwaukee County Stadium. So those are the Milwaukee landmarks that I've painted so far.
And tell me a little bit about the memories that you associate with those places.
I have a lot of memories with all these places. So far, all of the memory paintings that I've done are places that I have a personal connection to. So Atomic Records, I used to live above it on the Oakland side. Me and my buddy were DJs at the time. This was 2008 to 2009. So we had like four turntables set up in the living room. We'd go down to Atomic and buy records all the time. And then we actually lived there when it closed. So when I started this series and I thought about what to do in Milwaukee, Atomic was like the first thing that came to mind. And then Klingers East is just like very cozy kind of Wisconsin tavern. I have many fond memories of watching Packers games there and, just eating burgers and cheese curds and all that. And then County Stadium, I just went there all the time as a kid with my dad. We'd go to Brewers games all the time. And then Fuel Cafe, I didn't go there a ton when I lived here in 2008, 2009-ish. But I would definitely go there sometimes and just like sketch and hang out.
Can you walk me through the process you go through to create a tiny painting? From even the beginning step of how you decide what you're going to paint.
So first off, I look for things that are either visually interesting, like the Milwaukee Art Museum, or that have a personal connection to me, or that are just sort of weird roadside attraction-y, strange things, or that have like a big nostalgia factor. I made a tiny painting of the world's largest potato masher. In September, I went down to Iowa, made a tiny painting of the world's largest strawberry. I live right down the road from the world's largest hex nut. So yeah, always looking for these like weird, kind of kitschy roadside attraction type things. The second thing then is doing a lot of planning, actually. Sometimes I'll just go out into nature or wherever with my paints and like a blank canvas and just do something on the spot. More often than not, though, like I'll visit the place once, take a bunch of reference photos, kind of note the weather, note like where the sun is, note like if it can be a windy day or if I need it to be still. Is there going to be water? Do I need like the reflection of something? There's a lot of planning and thought that goes into that. And then once I'm ready to go, like I have a plan in mind, then I'll get my paint all together and everything and then like head out and then go make it. Some of these, though, I've done like at home. Obviously, I can't go and like see Atomic Records or County Stadium. So those I do at home after doing like a bunch of research. And so for the ones that no longer exist, like I'll try my best to find stuff online, photos to reference and things like that. Hopefully there was something like in an old newspaper. But also if it's something that's been around since 2007, I'll use the Google Maps Street View. So all of these things. And then basically when I'm ready to go, it's for these tiny paintings, it's just putting the oil paint in the bottom of the tin. And that's basically my palette. And I have a bunch of tiny brushes and then I go for it.
How long does each painting take you?
The tiny paintings, probably like 2 hours for a really intricate one. Like the Atomic Records one has a lot of detail, you know, a lot of lettering and things like that. Same with the Fuel Cafe one, Klinger's one. Actually, all the Milwaukee ones took about 2 hours now that I think about it.
And what would you say your favorite part of the process is when you're painting?
Well, I just like that you can do whatever you want. Like, it's pretty nice. Like, you can always change anything. The Fuel Cafe painting, I put a squirrel smoking a cigarette in there because I can. Things like that, you know, just paint a little happy cloud in there like Bob Ross. Doesn't matter. So I like the control, like when you paint, because you can just do anything. A lot of the cityscapes and things that I do, like I just leave out like the light poles, telephone poles, and like the wires and stuff like that, because I'm just trying to make a beautiful painting. So I think I just like that about painting, is that you have creative license to just change whatever you want.
I love that. And you also do big paintings, including abstract paintings. What inspires your abstract art?
When I'm trying to paint representationally, it's a lot of effort, takes a lot of work to do that. So after I've done that for a while, for a couple of months, I feel kind of burnt out. And sometimes I just want to like go be free. And so then I just sort of get into like a phase of abstract paintings. And for that, I usually use acrylic because it dries a lot faster and you can add a bunch of stuff to it to make it thicker, more textured, things like that. So I don't know. I feel like it's almost kind of like a release after doing these very planned out, painstakingly detailed representational type paintings.
So what's different about painting abstractly versus painting landscapes?
Well, the obvious difference is that painting landscapes is painting something representational, painting something that's there and easily recognizable, or abstract is, you know, it's just that, it's abstract. But I still feel like there's still some kind of a connection. Like a lot of the colors that I use for my abstract paintings are actually inspired by the National Park Service posters of the early 20th century. So something about the colors that they used spoke to me. So a lot of the abstract paintings I do still use that sort of theme. So I guess they're still kind of tied into nature a little bit. Also, a lot of my abstract paintings have kind of like a radial theme. So I feel like in one way or another, I know this is an abstract answer to a question about abstract paintings, but in one way or another, like I feel like there's still some sort of natural sort of feel to them.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that answer. Before we wrap up, I do want to ask you, what do you hope people come away with after seeing your artwork, tiny and normal-sized paintings?
Well, I just hope that they have fond memories of some of these places like I do, and it just sort of hits them in the nostalgic feels a little bit, and also just, you know, stop and appreciate what's there, because in my research, for all these paintings, like I found that it is very hard to find these photos of these places that are no longer there. So I don't know. I would say take a lot of pictures with your phone, because if a place goes out of business or is no longer there for whatever reason, like it's nice to be able to look back and see them.
Absolutely. Well, Nate, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your artwork with me.
Thanks for having me.
That was Wisconsin artist Nate Rose speaking with Lake Effect's Exgrid Nunez late last year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Exgrid Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Taryn Powell, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with the authors of Choosing Love, a book based on interviews with LGBTQ+ Christians about shame, pride, humility, love, and justice. That's Monday. For today, thank you so much for listening to Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.